by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Today, two investigative journalists join us to offer their insights into healthcare in America. Donald Barlett and James Steele are winners of the Pulitzer Prize. They're authors of seven books. Their latest is Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. Barlett and Steele see the American healthcare system on the verge of collapse. They report that per capita healthcare spending in the U.S. is high, very high. In 2001, it amounted to $4,887. In other developed nations, spending is thousands less. Our lifespan? Not longer, not the same. It is shorter. Our life expectancy ranks 29th in the world. To quote Barlett and Steele, Americans pay for a Hummer but get a Ford Escort. This is just one aspect of healthcare in America that the two journalists examine. They also look at how we've come to the situation we're in today and offer some ideas for correction. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. Donald Barlett and James Steele have worked together for more than three decades, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Since 1997, they've been editors-at-large for Time. They've won many national awards, including two Pulitzer Prizes and two national magazine awards. Their previous books include The Great American Tax Dodge and America, What Went Wrong. Their new book, Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine, is published by Doubleday. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Donald Barlett, James Steele, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Very nice to be with you, Celeste.
Really good to be with you.
We often hear from our political leaders and our leaders in healthcare that we have the best healthcare system in the world. You say not so. Let's begin with maybe taking a look at where we stand now. How does our healthcare system stack up?
Well, I think you put your finger on it earlier. In the terms of the healthy life expectancy, we rank 29th between Slovenia and Portugal, which doesn't say very much for our system. But the real problem is this. There are more than 100 million people out there who either have no coverage whatsoever or who are underinsured. And all of these other countries provide health care for 100% of their people at a fraction of what we spend, and they get better end results. And I think, you know, that kind of just sums it up. They spend less money to cover all of their people than we do to cover a fraction of our people.
Hmm. Now, who have we just heard from this afternoon?
I'm sorry, this is Don.
Okay, Don. Let me throw the next question then to Jim, if I can call you Jim.
Sure.
Who's likely to fall into these groups, the underinsured and the uninsured in the U.S.?
Well, this is a very good question because the perception that a lot of people have, and I think we to some extent a number of years ago had this perception, you think of the uninsured as folks at sort of the bottom of the economic ladder who do not work for an employer that provides health insurance or somehow are between jobs and so forth. And while that does, in fact, cover some of them, within the 100 million are a lot of people who also have insurance but don't realize that it will not come through for them if they have a major emergency. We tell the story in the book of a teacher in New Jersey and who had we call it a Cadillac health care plan, but it was sort of a catch-22 situation. She had a major significant illness in which she exhausted all her vacation time, all her sick leave time, and at the end of that particular situation, her health coverage was to be canceled, even though she had not recovered from some major surgery due to cancer and chemotherapy and so forth. She wasn't going to be covered because her policy, even though it was a good policy, required that she be working. I mean, that's one of the glitches in our system that, again, that Don was just talking about. You wouldn't see that somewhere else where somebody is really sick, really hospitalized, having to undergo one of those catastrophic bits of treatment that all of us hope never happens to us. Mm-hmm. If that happens to you in this country, very often people who think they're covered find out too late that the coverage has some huge holes in it. So the 100 million, a lot of these are not the poorest people. A lot of these are working poor or blue-collar folks at the bottom end of the rung whose employers cannot provide insurance or for whom it's too costly. They're people who may have a pre-existing condition that insurers now are deciding arbitrarily, well, we will not insure that person. So it's a whole range of people who are not necessarily just poor people, but who, because of circumstances, because of who they work for, because they've gone off on their own or have retired early, or extremely young in many cases and simply can't afford it, fall into that category.
How significant a factor are medical bills in filings for bankruptcy?
Medical bills, Celeste, are one of the prime factors behind bankruptcy. And this is especially hard hit are single mothers. They get into a position where they don't have adequate coverage. And Jim made this point that people, you know, the tendency is to think of poor people. This is not the case. These are working people, solid middle income jobs, who wind up with a medical problem all of a sudden that they didn't anticipate and that their insurance does not cover. And over the years, we've seen family after family who, when this occurred, and it usually often happens with children, with their children. They're trying to take care of their children, and they turn immediately to the credit cards and run up the credit card bills and ultimately end up in bankruptcy. So medical bills are a huge factor in bankruptcy and an especially huge factor for women.
Hmm. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us already this afternoon. Let's go and talk with our first caller who's listening in Indiana, calling in on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. I believe everything you're saying, and I've been keeping up with this, especially since I just retired, and I've learned some things that should be in the Medicare booklet, but it's not in there, unfortunately, or interpretations of such things. For example, what is, for example, like dental care. I went to an emergency room on an early morning and received some care because the left side of my face had swollen immensely. Then I was expected that it would be taken care of by my Medicare. It came back and it was rejected because it was a routine exam, and I thought, well, that's just a catch-all for some things, and I finally found out through my hospital that since it was considered a dental problem because it had dealt with the teeth and the jaw, turned out to be that I had a cap and that the root canal was not done sufficiently, so that there were bacteria remaining, and eventually over a period of time they grew to the place where that they caused the swelling and all that. And of course, Medicare pays nothing for dental care. Not even false teeth for elderly people, for example. Anecdotal thing. Second, since it is well known that we're the 29th country, how do they get past that kind of facts in Congress when they're brought to their attention? How does the Bush administration counteract these facts? What are they saying that it's necessary to keep the pharmaceuticals, you know, well positioned and things like that. It's always baffled me. I see so many Republican middle class people losing their insurance just for the reasons you said, but they continually to vote for these people. It's I find it very exasperating, really. I just don't understand it at all.
Well, he raises a very good point about this sort of disconnect on the issue of coverage and so forth. And what you see with the story he's just telling, one of the things we try to deal with in the book is that we have many stories in the book about what's happened to people across a whole range of geographical areas in the country and occupations and so forth. But we also tried to explain, to try to get at what has caused the turmoil. I mean, what is behind all of this? And for that, and this is why it's linked very much to his question on the pharmaceuticals and the drugs and why the Bush administration has basically given a carte blanche to the drug companies, that when you go back and you look at this 20, 25 years ago, we had a similar situation where healthcare costs were ballooning and Washington was very upset by this and Medicare was costing more. And they said, well, let's turn this over to private industry. Let's let the market, let for-profit companies into healthcare and bring some discipline to this chaotic field. We'll be able to cover more people. We'll be able to hold down costs. And good old American enterprise, which has worked so well in so many industries, will come through for us on this. And this has been just a catastrophic mistake, the belief that for-profit, market-based medicine will work in healthcare. Healthcare isn't like other industries. It's not like selling cars or apparel or television sets where you want to sell more of it. You don't want to sell more heart bypass operations or excess procedures and that thing, which is unfortunately part of this system works. You want to, you basically want to try to prevent people from having to have those major health calamities. But our system isn't set up that way. It's very much procedure-driven. But with the advent of so many of the for-profit sort of market-driven medicine, you've had a squeeze on all the various people in the healthcare system, patients, doctors, nurses, many, many hospitals. Everybody is being squeezed, and a lot of that money has flowed out to publicly held hospital corporations, HMOs, various other health insurers who are making an awful lot of money out of the healthcare system, money that used to be in the system when it was basically largely a non-profit or not-for-profit system. So the point of the book is that this whole experiment that we've had, which was to bring cost control and bring more people into this field, at the time, Washington embraced this back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. Healthcare costs comprised about 10% of our national wealth, gross domestic product. You know what they are now? They're 15.5%, heading for 16%. So after two decades of this experiment to control costs, they're more out of control than ever. There are more people than ever who do not have insurance. More people than ever have inadequate coverage. So the thing, and this is the point of the book, we just say healthcare is not like any other business. Until we recognize that, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. I've got a couple of other callers who are waiting, but I hope they'll bear with me here because I want one of you to tell us the story of Tenet Hospitals, because this gets to the point and illustrates the point that you were making, Jim, in that we have, you know, we have a big squeeze on, the bottom and the middle is getting squeezed, the profits are going up the ladder, and we have some procedure-driven medicine going on, and some of the procedures apparently not necessary.
Well, I assume you're talking about, we have a story in the book about a Tenet-owned hospital in Northern California, which had a couple of doctors who basically ran a cardiac factory, recommending various cardiac procedures to patients, which, according to the FBI later, very often did not need these procedures. But it was an extremely lucrative thing to do because many of these were Medicare patients, and they were, of course, able to charge a substantial amount of money for that. And it was the lure of those profits, the lure of making that certainly a profit-making hospital and keeping their numbers up, that was very much at the root of this. Even when people in the community sort of blew the whistle on the doctors and the whole operation there, the hospital tended to look the other way because it was very important for that institution to meet its numbers. Tenet began buying hospitals all over California. They've bought scores of them all over the U.S. And almost everywhere they have bought their hospitals, the folks who run them have been under immense pressure to always hit their numbers. It had to do sometimes with closing wards, shutting down rooms, laying off staff. Some Tenet hospitals have been sued for unclean conditions in their operating rooms and so forth. But again, all of these things largely driven by the desire to be, quote, more efficient and to bring home a profit. The most amazing thing about Tenet to us was that after the company was formed in the early 90s, the new chief executive did not have one ounce of experience in the whole medical field. His whole business had been in making deals, not even in healthcare, but in the entertainment industry. And he was brought in to run a healthcare company. And one of his initial acts was to move the company from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara because that's where his house was. And again, that's some of the kinds of excesses you see in healthcare that have been very detrimental to the interests of patients and doctors and certainly nurses.
One other fascinating aspect of Tenet was in its previous life, it was called National Medical Enterprises. And it was shot through with fraud and kickbacks and fraudulent billing and collapsed. And that's when Barbara was brought in, the Hollywood deal maker, to kind of put a new spin on this company, and they changed the name to Tenet, and then proceeded to do precisely the same thing. And during the early years, of course, Wall Street loved everything he was doing, and the numbers that Tenet was putting out there. Well, there was a reason for the numbers, and this trend just runs through the healthcare industry. We may not have world class healthcare, but we definitely have world class healthcare fraud.
Let's talk with some other listeners now. Next, we go to Coles County, listener on line one. Hello. Okay, let's try a listener in Eureka, line two. Hi.
Hi, very good, very timely subject. I'd like to know, what are the average increase in health care premiums for about the last 3 years? I have a plan from a small Protestant denomination which just outrages me because I just figured up, I think it's 26%, 25%, and 18% from the last 3 years, and all I get is a bunch of bunk when I've tried to talk to them about it. And what about, the same would be true for about the average cost increases in health care. Could you give a general figure?
The average family policy now is, and this is average nationally, obviously it's higher in some areas, a little lower in some areas, is upwards of $10,000. It's expected to reach $14,000 by next year.
Uh-huh. And do you know the percentage of the health care premium increase over the last year or couple of years?
I don't think either one has had that right in front of us at this moment, but your numbers sound very close to what just on our reading.
Would you find
that pretty much across the country?
Is Illinois higher than most surrounding states? Are you aware in terms of increase?
That I don't think we know.
I'm sure you could find some states that are probably lower, but they're very. Some of those numbers are very common for certainly. I know a number of states here in the east.
I heard a figure on the NBC Nightly News that healthcare had increased about 13% over the last year. Does that sound about right?
I think I heard that same figure. Yes.
The one thing you can be absolutely certain of is your share of that is going to go up sharply in the next few years, and here's the reason. Corporations now have taken a look at this cost and said, that's it for us. And again, these are averages. But on average, a corporation pays 80% of the premium and the employee picks up the other 20%. So if you have a $10,000 policy, the corporation's paying $8,000, you're paying $2,000. Corporations across the country have said, okay, that's it. We will continue to pay $8,000. But the employee will eat all future increases. So if the policy goes up $1,000 the next year, the employee will pay the $1,000, not the corporation. And this is one way that companies are looking at dealing with the exploding costs.
Thank you.
Following up on the listener's call, how much longer is this going to be sustainable? I mean, you could argue that it's not sustainable now, but...
Well, I think that's why we make the point that the system is on the verge of collapse. The solutions being tossed out in Washington just are not going to deal with this. And as more and more people are forced to spend this money, you're going to see they're going to be... Well, it'll be interesting to see how they'll respond. On the east, in the East Coast, there has now been in the last month or two a number of stories on Medicaid cutbacks, especially in New York State, which has one of the highest expenditures. And this is going to put added pressure on it because here are the weakest, the poorest of the lot, and now they're going to start shutting them out of the system, which will mean even less medical care for these people.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 3 in Champaign-Urbana. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, interesting books, but maybe what's this figure of $4,000 per year? Does that include, like, vitamins over the counter? Does it include legal costs or lawsuits and so on?
No, it would not include over the counter, that kind of expenditure. And that's, by the way, is up to almost... That was a several-year-old figure that's now well over 5, heading towards 6.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The thing you're talking about, legal costs, one of the points we try to make is that you hear a lot now about we've got to resolve the medical malpractice crisis. The problem is that medical malpractice is really a symptom of a failed system. And you could do anything you want to correct it, and it is not going to result in improved medical care one whit. It will shift costs around, it will shift expenditures around, but it will do nothing to improve the system, it will do nothing to give better medical care to people.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could discuss some ideal systems you'd like to recommend. We'll listen off the air, but some say the... other option is long waiting lines for national health services. Thanks.
Well, two things on the waiting lines. First of all, most of the European countries do have universal coverage, and the British system, I know in the past has certainly had some of that. That's not always true in a number of those other countries. The Canadian system is roundly discussed in this country for its alleged weights, but these are much more complicated than most of the stories would have you believe. For the most part, based on what we looked at, most of the people who are really ill in Canada can very often get coverage, certainly in many of the urban areas. Are there some weights up there? Yes, there are. But there are some tremendous waits in the United States anymore, depending on the kind of test you need, the procedure, depending on who your insurer is and what particular network you're in. You can't generalize about that anymore in the U.S. So we're manifesting a lot of those particular signs as well. So what they do is they provide a basis of coverage, every one of those other countries, that says if you get ill and you have to go to a hospital, he may not be risking the loss of your house, which is not true in this country for people who lack insurance. I mean, there are hospitals all over this country who have sued people for hospital bills when they were unable to pay huge prices charged them for whatever procedure happened, simply because they did not have insurance, because their insurance companies weren't able to negotiate some kind of a break for them. So that's the point we make in the book. At least elsewhere, you have a foundation of care. That doesn't mean somebody has that axe hanging over their head if they have to seek care. And there have been studies after studies that show that many people who do not have insurance very often pay a real price for it because for one reason or another, they do not seek treatment when early detection of an illness might go a long way towards saving their life or at least minimizing the expenditures down the line when they become quite ill. So there's no ideal system out there, and we make that point in the book. I mean, there's healthcare is such a crazy situation, but at least other countries have established a foundation of care, and that's what we haven't, and what little basis exists out there for most people is rapidly eroding.
Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line 4. Hi.
Hello. I'm joining the show late, so if you've already gone over this ground, please don't again. But the current administration, it seemed, would have us believe that the primary problem with health care delivery in America has to do with tort reform, that somehow we have sued our way into this crisis. You seem to speak to that a little bit in response to the last caller. Could you address precisely where the costs of litigation actually impact health care costs? And I'll hang up and listen because I'm driving down the interstate.
Well, obviously, where the greatest impact is on physicians. There's no question about that. There's no question there are frivolous lawsuits, and they abound. But what no one talks about are the just totally outrageous mistakes that are made that will leave people, you know, and basically destroy their lives. What do we do with them? Do we just kind of chuckle and say, "Well, you lost the medical lottery there"? It's important to keep in mind that, and this again is something that few people talk about. The third leading cause of death in this country is medical mistakes. Nobody talks about it. Heart disease, cancer, medical mistakes, and the fourth leading cause, strokes, isn't even close to mistakes. And so there is a room for medical malpractice litigation. There's no question that it's excessive. There's no question that you have frivolous lawsuits. But if the healthcare system was fixed, much of the medical malpractice problem would disappear on its own.
The one thing we know for sure is that even frivolous lawsuits, malpractice lawsuits, don't come anywhere close to the costs generated by the bureaucracy that's grown up in healthcare, which we point to in our book as being totally unnecessary. Because what we've done by this whole sort of market-based system is we've created all of these providers, and they all have their own systems by which they provide coverage. And if you go into the average doctor's office anywhere in this country, they have this whole staff of people who are simply processing the paper. And the reason for that is because there's so many different kinds of systems out there. There have been any number of studies that have shown that the U.S. system, despite all the way we always pride ourselves on our efficiencies and so forth, is in many ways the most inefficient healthcare system of any of the developed countries. Some of these studies show that as much as one out of three healthcare dollars go to this administration, the red tape. It's everything from the folks in the doctor's office to the call centers run by the insurers to on down the line. That's totally an unnecessary charge that has nothing to do with truly providing patient health care. And anybody who's had problems with a health insurer, their 800 number, or getting a referral, or problems in a doctor's office because some kind of an approval didn't come through, knows exactly what we're talking about on that. And that is... perhaps the single biggest cost that's out there in terms of waste in the healthcare system.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line 1. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. Do you talk at all in your book about workers' compensation and the cost associated with that and how that impacts the whole picture of what you're discussing today?
No, we do not deal with workers' comp at all. This was, I mean, we started out to kind of just keep the focus on health care. What kind of health care are we getting for our dollar? And even how does it stack up with what people in other countries are getting? One of the lines you often hear is, well, we have to have world-class health care because we have these people coming from abroad for surgery here. It's evidence on itself that we have world-class health care. But in fact, what you have are some very wealthy people coming here to pay cash for really good quality, high-tech surgical procedures. There's no question about that. But those aren't available to most people.
Does the listener want to follow up? Okay.
Well, I just was wondering, you know, in this country, of course, if you get hurt, I think sometimes the first question might be, did you get hurt at work or did you get hurt at home? And then you have different health care policies that might kick in. And I don't know if other countries do that or if we're the only country that does that, and it just seems kind of schizophrenic.
Oh, I think you put your finger. I didn't realize that's where you were going with this question. That is a critical question because it goes back to the heart of the first caller who winds up in an emergency room with a jaw problem and which Medicare takes a look at and says, oh, no, gee, this really is a tooth problem. We don't cover teeth, so you're on your own. You have all of these loopholes, conflicting plans, which people don't find out whether they're covered or not until it is too late. By contrast, in France or in Germany, you walk into the doctor's office, you get treated, and that's it, period. It doesn't matter where it came from or how you suffered the injury. You get treated, and it doesn't matter. You don't have to get a referral. You don't have to go through any of that. Interestingly, the European countries are also moving at warp speed ahead of us in terms of bringing the records keeping, medical records keeping, into the electronic age. Italy, for one, expects by 2010 to have everything computerized, and you'll have your own like a credit card, and everything will be there.
And they will be able to, from that, track the performance of various medications. They'll see what kinds of procedures are being performed on down the line. Now, we have a system in this country because of this, quote, competition among so many of the private insurers that so many of those people, because of this competition, most of the health insurers can't even talk to each other. Their computers can't identify the work of the other. So what sense does that make in a unified country like America with the mobility we have with people moving all over here and so forth, for the systems to not be able to communicate with one another?
Let's talk with another listener. Another cell phone call, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I couldn't agree with you more, especially with the craziness, if you happen to have double coverage, a husband and a wife, and the coordination of benefits, and it just goes on and on and on. It's you have to submit and resubmit and triple submit,
right. And
the people are in these offices with paperwork stacked to the ceiling. I mean, it is very inefficient. One thing, too, is, and I don't know what part of healthcare this cost is, these proliferation of agencies that will rent items like a nebulizer or oxygen concentrator. They buy these things for maybe $200-$300 and rent them for that much per month and charge insurance companies or Medicare, and it goes on and on and on, and it's absolute craziness.
Well, I mean, once again, you put your finger on this business of the paperwork and people making money out of the system. You know, Jim and I are really strong proponents of the capitalist system and of the marketplace. The marketplace works if you're selling cereal. It does not work when it comes down to treating people with illnesses. There was this riff by Chris Rock, the comedian, and he's talking about medications in particular. And the drug companies really don't want to cure something. They just want to be able to sell the drugs to treat something over and over. And he has this great line. He says, you think they're going to cure AIDS? No, they ain't going to cure AIDS. They ain't never curing AIDS. No money in curing it. The money's in the medicine. That's how you get paid. Sick people coming back and back. And that really sums up the thrust of American healthcare. It is not in preventing illness, in preventing disease, and encouraging people not to get sick. It's just basically the same old thing in treating them, which generates a lot of money for very few businesses.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, investigative reporters Don Barlett and Jim Steele. They are editors-at-large for Time. Their latest book, Critical Condition, How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad medicine. You're invited to call listeners and join the discussion. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back to the phones, a listener in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if our problems are not much more deeper in the sense of a systemic approach to almost anything we do. We have a patchwork approach to whatever we do, whether it's education or healthcare. I'm thinking that, for example, even when we consider free market working in the healthcare system, that we seem to ignore that a national system or universal coverage system in which some amount of set up with public money may be involved, that we don't consider taxpayer as shareholders in this endeavor, but we are ready to consider shareholders in other enterprises as legitimate players. And I have lived in Europe for a long time, and I know that the system there functions a lot better, even though they do have choices among several insurance companies. They're all national level, and their administrative costs are much lower. And as you mentioned, the system does deliver better results for the buck. And I have some issue with the way we approach these problems and are dogmatically wedded to so-called free market and selectively use that to mean what certain levels of political circles want us to believe. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Very interesting point the gentleman raises, and absolutely right. And in terms of healthcare, is a perfect example of the patchwork approach we've had. We'll do something over here on Medicare, supposedly for the drug issue, and we'll do something over here on Medicare for what doctors are paid. We will maybe set up a program for children that, if you meet certain requirements, you can get your health benefits. But all of these are these. If you look at healthcare, there's just a blizzard of various things out there that may or may not apply to people. Where if you had standard coverage of a certain basis that covered everyone, it would just immediately eliminate a lot of this red tape, a lot of the bureaucracy, a lot of questions about, well, let's see if we can find something that applies to you. And it is why, in every one of those European countries, that you do see that administrative costs are substantially below what they are here. And what's happened in this country, though, is it's just been a substantial move into this whole market-based concept over the last 20 to 25 years. I mean, there have always been some privately owned hospitals, but this whole movement got a tremendous shot in the arm from the 1980s on. Even to this day, even the not-for-profit institutions, the hospitals that are not owned by stockholders, even they feel, in many cases, they must behave like profit-making entities, or they somehow will be vulnerable or be accused of mismanaging the institution. I mean, almost everybody has been caught up in this. But something will change. I mean, Don and I were struck by, when we went around the country talking to doctors, nurses, people in the healthcare field, things are, the ground is shifting under this issue, and it may be a little while before something major really happens, but this whole system is skidding, falling apart in some parts of the country and just absolute disintegration. And as that gets worse and worse, there's going to be a call to call a halt to it, because there's a lot of good people and there's a lot of great technology in this country with healthcare, and we shouldn't emphasize that point. But it is the system as a whole which is just not meeting our needs.
Yeah.
The point that Jim makes there is really important. The people who have to work in this system are unbelievably frustrated by it. And there are just a lot of really good healthcare people. And that what they have to put up with day in and day out is just makes no sense whatsoever. Your last caller made this point in this fragmented system, and that's exactly what it is. It's these little bits and pieces, and then we pretend that that really works, and it's good.
Yeah. I've got a couple of callers waiting to talk with us, and I'm going to try and get to them very quickly here.
Sure.
But before we do that, I do want to ask you, you know, about your idea for correcting the situation. What does the remedy involve? And as far as you two are concerned, it's a single-payer system, but you do, you know, raise the issue at the end of the book. Well, how do we get there given all the political baggage single-payer system has at the moment in our country?
Well, you know, as your caller indicated, there's this knee-jerk response or dogmatic response from certain segments that just doesn't want to deal with this issue. So we realize going in, we can't make this universal health care under the government, like even though Medicare is, because there are just too many people opposed to it on the basis of slogans. Well, that's socialized medicine, as if we don't have socialized education in which everybody gets an education. But to take it that, remove that argument, we thought was really important. So we proposed creating a kind of quasi-independent agency along the lines of the Federal Reserve Board for health care. Divide the country into different regions, just as the Federal Reserve is. Have the board members pointed to staggering terms so that no political party, no president could gain control. And also have outside people sitting on the board, and non-medical people, people who use the system and who know how it works, and just do this totally independently and provide a basic level of coverage for everyone. You walk in, you're sick, you get treated, you leave. No referrals, no paperwork, nothing. And we think that this would work, and we think you could do it for a lot less money than we're spending now. It would mean that certain institutions would be getting a lot less money. Hospital chains, there would be no need for large profit margins, for dividend payments to shareholders. The name of the game is health care, and it's not to achieve anything else. The other thing it would allow us to do is to put more emphasis on preventive medicine rather than treating people, to head off illnesses, to head off diseases. And at the same time, you know, general practitioners in this country are seeing their paychecks just shrink unbelievably. And we've encountered, I don't know how many doctors, especially young doctors, coming out of medical school with huge student loans, they can barely eke by on what they're making. And that's wrong. And it's wrong that the system is geared toward paying for procedures. What we want is good health care for everyone at a reasonable price, and then everyone involved in it earns a reasonable salary.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get another caller or two in here before we have to wrap up. Line 2, Champagne, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to suggest another approach to things, starting by observing that what was done 20-some years ago involved a lot of privatization, but it isn't really market-based. But what it is a collective monopoly. And one of the consequences of collective monopoly is that markets don't work as well as they should. And another is that in the medical field, there really is not anything like open competition at any level, even scientifically. As I think you observed earlier, the way profits are made are by having people get treatment throughout their lives rather than be cured. And if one looks in the recent history of medicine, there are many situations where somebody has come up with a very good treatment that has been killed off in one way or another. And I would suggest to you that what is needed really is a genuine market-based system that would operate as follows, that the laws governing the legal practice of medicine would be relaxed to the point where anyone could go into the business of taking money for healing. They could not engage in fraud. They can't say I have a medical degree if they don't. They could easily be required to specify to every in their office and to every patient what their training is and what their experience is, and that could be checked by the journalists, among others. And then once that was done, then you just say that a medical assurance is outlawed and people have to pay for what they get. And I suggest that these two things together would immediately bring a lot more people into the field. There's lots of people out there who have medical training of various sorts that could operate as primary care. And it would also mean that the medical schools could leave off producing only Cadillac doctors, and you can only get medical training or you can only get medical treatment if you can pay for a Cadillac. That, for example, someone could be trained to do a very complicated heart operation and only that. And they could be trained in a year or two if they have the relevant talent, and you don't have to pass organic chemistry on the way.
I'm going to jump in there and ask our guests to respond because we've got to wrap up.
Well, I think one of the things that that we see from this is that there's no doubt many folks in medical school certainly are going into certain specialties because simply the debts that are run up going through medical education nowadays alone drive certainly a lot of doctors into that. I think we would still need a floor of coverage for almost everybody, though, because the simple cost that some procedures might and some care might require would certainly be beyond the means of, I think, of most people to bear. I mean, and what we're talking about in our thing is, you know, there could be, and we're not wedded any one thing here. We're just saying we need to establish a base. We need to establish a foundation of care. Beyond that, there are many, many possibilities as to how that might work out there. And your caller is certainly right in the sense there isn't much competition. But it also, medicine is different than other things. I mean, the average person probably doesn't want competition in healthcare the way he wants competition in buying a car. As it's certain points of references with consumer items that a person can educate themselves about. With healthcare, there very often isn't the opportunity to do that. Something happens. You need to have faith in whoever your doctor is, and we don't really see that changing much. What we think needs to happen is the folks in the field, doctors, nurses, need to be properly compensated, and the folks who need that care, the patients, need to know that they're not going to face economic ruin, perhaps, if they have to seek that care.
That's where we have to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you, Jim Steele and Don Barlett. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Very nice to be with you.
Thank you so much, Celeste. It was very, very enjoyable.
Our two guests this afternoon, editors at large for Time, their latest book is Critical Condition, How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. The book is published by Doubleday. 6 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a tough day in the corn and soybean pits. If you are a producer, we saw the May through March contracts in corn and the May through the November contracts in the soybeans, as well as the products in the soybeans, all set new contract lows. We'll discuss why that happened with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, on the closing market report that gets underway at 6 minutes after 2 o'clock this afternoon. Let's go ahead and look at the settlements. March, wheat, a high on the day of 299 and 3 quarters, a low of 295, settling 296 and a half down 1. May, a high of 307, a low of 302 and a half, settling 304 and a quarter down 1. July, a high of 314 and a quarter, a low of 309 and a half, settling 311 and a half down 3 quarters. September, a high of 319 and a half, a low of 316, settling 317 down 1 and a quarter. December wheat, a high of 328 and a half, a low of 324 and a half, settling 325 down 1 on the day. March corn, a high of 197.25, a low of 195.5, settling 196, down 1.25. May, a high of 204.5, a low of 202.75, settling 203.5, down 1.25. July, a high of 211.75, a low of 210.25, settling 210.5, down 1.5. September, a high of 219.25, a low of 217.75, settling on the low, down 1.25. December, a high of 228.25, a low of 226.75, settling 227, down 1.5. March, a high of 236, a low of 234.25, settling on 234.5, down 2. March Oats, the winner on the day in terms of rallying on the market, a high of 172, a low of 162, settling on the day's high, up 7.75 on the day. May, a high of 157.5, a low of 154, settling 157.5, up 2.5. March soybeans, a high of 519, a low of 512.5, settling 513.5, down 6. May, a high of 522, a low of 516, settling 516.25, down 6.5. July, a high of 528.5, a low of 522.25, settling 522.75, down 6. August, a high of 529.5, a low of 525.25, settling 525.25, down 5.5. September, a high of 532.5, a low of 526.5, settling 526.5, down 4.5. November, a high of 540, a low of 535, settling 536.75, down 5.5. And November beans, a high of 540.5, a low of 535, settling 535.75, down 5.5 on the day. March soybean meal, a high of 154.20, a low of 152, settling 153.70, down 110. May, a high of 155.70, a low of 153, settling 154.70, down 170. March soybean oil, a high of 1973, a low of 1941, settled 1944, down 19. In the May contract, a high of 1989, a low of 1957, settling on the low, down 25 on the day. Settlement prices are also in from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where Celeste, the feeder cattle, had quite a rally today.
They did indeed. January feeder cattle, 107.27.5, the high, 106.20, the low, 107.20, the settlement, that up 135. March, 103.25, the high, 102.40, the low, 102.85, the settlement, that up 70. April, 101.60, the high, $100.65, the low, the settlement, 101.25, that up 65. February live cattle, 91.70, the high, 91.02.5, the low, 91.12.5, the settlement, that down 20. March, 91.80, the high, 91.80, the low, and the settlement, down 20. April, 89.50, the high, 88.85, the low, 89.42.5, the settlement, that up 27.5. February lean hog, 77.15, the high, 75.35, the low, 75.57.5, the settlement, that down 120. April, 78.60, the high, 77.10, the low,